Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Book Discussion, and this is Fran Lewis back again. And I want to thank the gods of suns for taking the rain away, because it was horrible this morning and pouring. It's beautiful outside. The sun is shining, and the sun is shining inside, too. How lucky me. And I'm going to talk to one of my favorite new authors. I've read this book. It's called Phantom Limb, a Daniel Nald mystery. And we have author Dennis Palumbo here. And the beginning of your book, really, that first page really gets you. First of all, hi, how you doing?
Fine, friend. Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm just so excited to have you on. And this is really a great book. It really is. And
thanks.
First of all, it's one of those, I should say hello to you from John Land, because if I don't say hello, he's going to get upset. I interviewed him yesterday. And he says a huge hello. Carla Negger says a huge hello. And Tom Sawyer, who was on my show 2 weeks ago, he says hello, too. Everybody says hello.
I'll say hello back to all of them.
Yeah, well, it was like, this is so much fun, really. But why did you decide to choose the title Phantom Limb? And second of all, how come you chose to start the plot with, what would you do if somebody gave you 50 minutes to convince them not to kill themselves? That was really good. That's when I started to read the book. I go, okay, this is going to be bad because I'm not going to put it down. I couldn't.
Well,
and if I read a book like that so fast, I get eye strain, but that's okay.
Well, you know, for your listeners who may not know, the novel Phantom Limb is the fourth suspense mystery in the series starring Daniel Rinaldi, who is a psychologist and trauma expert who consults with the Pittsburgh police. And, you know, the reason I picked Phantom Limb is I was reading about Phantom Limb, which is the syndrome that a person who's lost an arm or a leg has. The feeling that missing limb is still there, that it itches at night or is cold, and you know, it has to do with the many, many returning Afghan vets or people who've been in an accident and had to have a leg or an arm amputated report having this syndrome, which is the feeling that this arm or this leg is actually still there. And so one of the main characters in the novel, Phantom Limb, is a returning veteran who is struggling with this. It's not the main story, it's the B story. I used the syndrome of phantom limb in the novel as a metaphor for the fact that we all have a felt sense that someone in our life is missing, whether it's, you know, due to a bitter divorce or the loss through death of a loved one. You know how you walk around and it's hard to believe they're really gone. And sometimes you have to remind yourself they're really gone. And most people I know have that feeling about a relationship or a family member, a beloved family member who's died. So I use it as a metaphor because my lead character, Daniel Rinaldi, lost his wife. He's a widower. And so I use that as a metaphor throughout the book. As to your second question about where did I get the idea of a patient coming into a therapist's office and saying, I'm going to kill myself tonight, you have 50 minutes to talk me out of it, it's because it actually happened to me.
Oh, wow.
Not any way like it happened in the book. I was an intern therapist, so this goes back about 30 years. And a woman came in, and she didn't quite announce it like this. This is all, I slightly fictionalized it. But she essentially said, look, I'm thinking of killing myself tonight, and you better be able to talk me out of it. And so it wasn't that difficult to talk her out of it and say, let's have another session tomorrow. She mostly just needed someone to talk to. But what I did is I always remembered her saying that to me, and thought, man, if I ever write a story, that's going to be a great way to open the book. And so that's why I did it. But all the details are changed. You know, she wasn't a former Hollywood starlet. She wasn't from Pittsburgh. None of those things were true. They were all created by me.
That was, I said, oh my God, okay, how's he going to get out of it? How's she going to get out of it? What is he going to do? And then she disappears.
Yeah, and she gets kidnapped. And the book is about his attempt to help her family and the police and the FBI get her safely returned. And I've been very gratified by the reviews and by the response the book has gotten. So I'm glad you liked it too, Fran.
Oh, I love this book, and I'm going to post the review today because you are part of the blog tour for Partners in Crime, and
right.
They hook me. I don't even have to ask anymore. It's scary. If they don't, if I don't respond, they have a fit. They send out a. I cracked up with it. Can you possibly take on 4 more books because no one else is going to do it? And I'll say, I could take on 2, and then I'll spotlight 2 more because I can't read all of them. You know, give me a day or two, whatever. So I saw that yours was up for today, so I'm going to post it after the show with a bunch of other ones that I have to post today. It's a good thing that I have this little calendar on my computer or forget it. But, yeah, Partners in Crime constantly sends me things. Do you know, can you do this? So I said I would post yours this afternoon after the show so that everybody is going to want to read it, and I can post it on my 27,000 review sites that I have also.
Excellent. Nothing like,
yeah.
I love the spreading the good word.
Oh, without a doubt, you're going to get a lot of good words. And from what I understand, everybody reads my words. I don't know why, but they really do. And like Larry
Thompson.
Well,
that's Thompson, a good thing, right?
Yeah, it is, because sales go up on everybody's books except my own, because I don't blog my own, brag about my own. Terrible.
Oh, my gosh. Well, maybe you need to create a false identity and have that person brag on your books.
I might actually do that because my 6th edition of my magazine, which even when you mentioned Phantom Limb, the person I can't believe is that's not here is my sister. We're not, really not sure what happened that caused her death. It's sort of up in the air, big question mark, yeah. She had a massive heart attack, but we don't really know why. And she didn't have heart problems, to be very honest. And she was thin like me, so we don't really know. And my sister, to keep her alive, I created MJ Magazine. And I'm very happy to say that John Land and Roger Ellery and Alan Topol and a whole bunch of New York Times bestselling authors have written articles in this magazine. And the next one, which is coming out in a couple of weeks, is the theme is Overcoming Obstacles. And yeah. Uh-huh. And the one that's going to be for the one in January, I thought of Ordinary People Do Extraordinary Things.
Well, ordinary people do extraordinary things every day.
That's
so I think it's a very good topic for a magazine, too.
Yeah, so I'm going to try to get a whole bunch of people, anybody that wants to volunteer, to write articles about what they do and you know how they do it. I don't care what it is. So I've already, you know, threatened the guy in the bakery with an interview. And the guy in the, he said he would do it. It'll be hilarious. And the guy in the pizza place that, you know, makes me my egg whites in the pizza place. Actually, he does. So, which is really great. So, Lisa, you could either like her or hate her, right? I mean,
yeah, it's funny. It kind of goes down the middle. Lisa Campbell, the person you're referring to, is the former Hollywood starlet who came back from Hollywood after a bunch of, you know, scandals and disappointing films and met and married this gazillionaire CEO of a Fortune 500 company. And, you know, so she and this man who's much, much older have, you know, sort of taken over Pittsburgh's social calendar. But when we meet her, she's not only talking about suicide, but she's a very cynical, foul-mouthed person, very much like a lot of the people in, you know, in the Hollywood community. And I like her a lot because from my own experience, I know many people like Lisa, male and female, and they cover up their vulnerability and their heartache and the disappointments in their life by being funny and cynical and bitter.
Mm-hmm.
I also have some readers who go, oh, I don't like her at all. But because my narrator, Daniel Rinaldi, her therapist, likes her, we tend to like who he likes. And he sees right through her facade of cynicism at how vulnerable she really is underneath.
Well,
Did you like this?
I like him. He's very astute. I thought he was really good. I mean, he gets in trouble a little bit. And every time this poor guy doesn't want to get involved and go back to that mansion, he gets stuck going back because he's like, has no choice, which he really doesn't. So,
no, not structured it. When you have an amateur sleuth like he is, one of the hardest things is to give the novel verisimilitude, that the reader can actually believe that this person, who's not really a policeman, even though he works with the police, be involved in this situation. But the way I've structured the novel, it's inevitable that he'd be involved, and he doesn't have any options.
Yeah, I know, he's left with that. If you don't do it, something's going to happen, and if you don't do it, we're going to kill her, we're going to do this. Which makes it even more credible, yeah. Oh, my God. And then I'm saying, I know that you're a psychotherapist. I said, oh, gosh, how many people did he meet like this in the world? And do you ever get in that kind of situation?
Actually, no.
No?
I share a lot of traits with Daniel Rinaldi. I mean, we were both born
and
raised. And we both went to Pitt, and we're both therapists, and we both have a beard and glasses. But I think other than that, we both kind of have the same view of the mental health profession, and we do therapy in a very similar way, I'm not anywhere near as brave and resourceful as he is, and I did not have an alcoholic cop as a father, and I wasn't a former amateur boxer, so he has some of my traits, and then I kind of glamorized him up a little bit.
Well, that's what makes him so cool.
Yeah. Well, Kirkus Review called him Jack Reacher with a psychology degree, which is a description I love. So
he's really cool. So we have to bring in this other character, who I couldn't make up my mind about this one. He was okay to a point. Who is Mike Payton, and why was he so protective of Lisa? And what happens when he finds out that she's missing?
Yeah, the character of Mike Payton is the head of security for Lisa's husband's family and for his business, Harlan Enterprises. And so he feels, you know, as a former military man, he has a lot of pride and believes very much in duty and his mission. And so he feels as though Lisa was kidnapped on his watch. And as a result, he tends to overreact and, filled with bluster, would like to shoot the kidnappers, is very suspicious of everyone, and because he feels as though he let the family down. And as we go along in the novel, we also learn there's some other reasons why he feels responsible and guilt-ridden. And I think it makes him an interesting character as the novel unfolds. He's not exactly what he seems. And one of the things I strive to do in all of my Daniel Rinaldi novels, from the first one to this one, is characters are not exactly what they seem to be. That people have, like in real life, hidden dimensions, secrets, and operatic passions that they try to keep under control. And as a therapist, I'm very interested in the human condition, obviously, why people do what they do, how they really behave as opposed to how they want people to think they are. And those are the elements that make, I think, a compelling mystery.
Yeah, it does. It really is, because people often want people to believe certain things about them because certain things have to be hidden. They don't want anybody to know the real truth, even when you meet new people.
Yeah, that's true. And if you think of all the mysteries and suspense novels that you've read and enjoyed, people have secrets, people's motives are hard to fathom, and if the books are any good, there's some two or three reasonable twists. I always like to have a couple twists in my book that the reader doesn't see coming.
Well, you did it at the end of this one, that's for sure.
I'm glad you liked it.
Well, you know, the good part is that I liked it. The bad part is that when I finish a book in an hour and a half, my eyes start to bother me. And that's where this book came in, and Strong Darkness by John Lynn came in. And believe me, the only other author that I get said is Steve Berry, The Lincoln Myth. And I actually took 4 days to read it because I knew that if I started it and read 498 pages in one day, I'd be in big trouble.
Yeah,
and besides, I wanted to make sure that I got the research, whatever. And when John said to me yesterday, he wrote about Judge Roy Bean, and he said my research was more extensive than his because I have a tendency as I do. That's why I asked you the other question about the other book that I'm reviewing. If I see that an author writes something, you know, that deals with the past or requires, when I just read them with dyslexia or whatever, I'm going to look it up to make sure that it's accurate.
I think that's wise. I think that makes you a good reviewer.
Yeah, that also makes it that if the person is not right and there's something not credible, I may not put that in the review, but I will let them know that it brings it down sort of. And of course, if I really think that the book is totally not credible and that happened like once or twice, I won't review it at all. I'll just write a summary. And they can use it for whatever they want because I won't rate the book. And
wow.
I learned this. Yeah, I won't. I know it sounds weird.
No, it doesn't sound weird. In fact, one of the things I'm proud of, in you know, other than the fact I think my books are suspenseful and twisty and clever, is the material about the mental health industry, about psychiatric diagnoses, about syndromes and conditions, and about how people respond to trauma. Is all very accurate stuff and fairly right up to the moment, state of the art stuff. Where I get in trouble is that even though I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, I've lived in Los Angeles for 40 years. So when it comes to the topography of the city of Pittsburgh, which is where my books take place, I rely on Google and maps and friends and stuff. Mm. And all my readers in Pittsburgh, when they email me or call me, it's never to talk about the plot or the characters. It's always to say, hey, you can't make a left on South Street there. What's wrong with you? You know, or, you know, so they always have problems if I get the street names wrong or if I say something was east of Pittsburgh when it's south of Pittsburgh. And it is amazing to me how proprietary Western Pennsylvania readers are about the accuracy of my descriptions of streets and towns. And
maybe.
It always makes me laugh. So
I had a woman who
read the first three books, and she finally had to email me and tell me that the way I had my character, Daniel Rinaldi, go home every night was not the most efficient one during rush hour. And she told me a better way, and that's the way I have Daniel go home now, starting with Phantom Limb. And in the acknowledgement, I acknowledged her and said, thanks a lot for giving me the information on the best way for Daniel Rinaldi to get home. And good kick out of the fact she's in the acknowledgements for having given me that information.
I'm trying
but
to look at
my favorite
see,
email I just got a couple months ago from a woman who's
that.
A city planner in Pittsburgh who corrected me on a couple of the streets and the directions of the streets and said, look, from now on, just call me. And I'll tell you which way he should go. So people take that very seriously.
That is really good though, because it keeps you, you know, straight, honest and whatever. But, you know, it's the setting and it's important and people they protect where they live. But when I get a book and the police investigation, and I've read like 4,000, the police investigation is corrupted and handled wrong, then I get like, I can't read this, it's no good. I mean,
I have a number of police officers, including a former robbery homicide detective, and I run some of this stuff by them, and it's pretty accurate. I would say, like most mystery novels, the only part that's slightly inaccurate is that the policemen that my hero deals with are only working on this one case. In real life, they're always working about four cases. But that's what they do in Law and Order, too. You know, the reader can't really follow it if we actually saw what Harry Bosch did during a day, it wouldn't be solving one case. But that's what you have to do, you know, for a mystery to be cohesive. But I do try to make the police procedural part as accurate as I can make it.
Well, to me it seemed fine. So why didn't they want, but in this particular book, you said that they had better not call the police. And Lieutenant Beagler's problem was with Danny because he didn't want him to be summoned. And you got to describe Harland. Oh, my God.
Well,
oh, my God. I pictured him as Blake Carrington in a wheelchair.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. He's a very kind of old, crotchety, 80-year-old billionaire, actually, in a wheelchair, who's married to Lisa, who's about 35 years younger than he is, and who has a kind of God complex. And the only, you know, Lieutenant Beagler and all the members of the Pittsburgh police usually are fairly reluctant to have my character involved in their investigations, but they can't do much about it in this case because Charles Harland demands that Daniel be part of the investigation. Now, he demands it for the wrong reason. He is upset and embarrassed and angry that Lisa went to Daniel for therapy. And he's always saying to Daniel, we got to get alone in a room so you can tell me what she said. And Daniel always keeps saying, that's confidential. I'm not going to discuss my treatment of Lisa with you. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those guys to whom the word no is never said. And so the tension between Harlan, the police, and Daniel Rinaldi forms a big bulk of the book. And then when you add in the fact that the police, the Pittsburgh police, and the FBI are rivals, as they are in real life, by the way, that's a very realistic aspect of the book because they're each trying, you know, they'll get a new piece of evidentiary material and they won't share it.
Yeah.
And if you recall from the novel, when the FBI knows something, they're reluctant to tell the police. And when the police know something, they're reluctant to tell the FBI. Each one wants to be the ones that makes the collar. And that is very, very realistic.
That's scary because the person that's committing the crime should be their primary focus, and getting the person that's committing the crime should be their primary focus, not who gets the glory and what difference does it make.
I know it makes.
If you share, yeah, it's like two little kids fighting over a basketball. And who's going to get the ball to make the last score?
But as we know, that was the situation before 9/11. The FBI and the CIA were each in possession of fundamental pieces of the puzzle, and they did not share the information.
And that's why that happened.
I
lost a student that day. One of my students.
Oh my gosh!
First hour, yeah. You know, it was really weird because the mother came in and. It was my birthday 2 days before, and Janine came to school, brought her nephew, and she went to work on the 11th, whatever, and a couple of weeks later, the mother came in, and I said, you know, how's my girl? How's she doing? I had no idea, and when she told me, I just cracked up. I said, oh, my God, you couldn't even talk to me. I mean, this was someone that I hadn't... two classes in the fourth and fifth grade and fifth and sixth grade, and now she was 20-something years old, and she was doing so well in this big corporation, and she was going to become a lawyer because she was amazing. And when I said, oh, my God, this shouldn't have, you know, you just don't believe it. It's like one of those phantom limbs that you don't, how could that happen? So I dedicated one of my books to her.
Oh.
Memory, yeah. I wrote five children's books on bullying. And I put them together into two separate books, Bertha and Tilly, Sisters Forever, and Bertha and Tilly Forever, two stories that my sister and I and our antics when we were growing up.
Mm.
And yeah, they're hilarious because I'm a little wild. But
well, I also can see how important your relationship with your sister was.
Yeah, it was. She was my rock, and she would center me. So I don't get angry that easily, but when I felt my blood pressure boiling and going up to normal, because thank God I have low blood pressure, I would call her up and I'd go to her, this is what I'm going to do if you don't tell me not to do it. And she would do the same thing. This is
well,
what I'm going to do.
You were each other's moral compass. That's not a bad thing to have.
It wasn't, but she was also my poem partner. and I stopped writing poems because I didn't have my partner to help write them. We would write poems for her office, you know, to diss on the doctors and the staff. And we would write, you know, roast everybody, and it was hilarious. I would start and she was finished, and we would sit there for 2 hours cracking up. Well, eyes would be absolutely hysterical. And then there's nobody to write a poem with. What can I say?
Yeah. But anyway. See, that's a significant loss for you.
Yeah. She was a pain in the neck, but what could I tell you? But we loved her. But what was Jake Harlan's problem? That's the son.
James? Yeah.
Jake. Yeah, Jake. He got bombed all the time, and he hated Lisa. Poor Lisa. Not everybody liked Lisa.
Well, you know, if you're James Harlan, if you're the only son left, and you're going to inherit all this money from your father, who you don't like, and he doesn't like you, and all of a sudden, a former Hollywood starlet, now kind of gone, you know, past her prime, gets married to your dad, and now you're thinking to yourself, if you're James, oh, my God, the money's going to go to her, not to me. Plus, he was embarrassed because he was afraid that people would think, you know, his dad was a deluded old man and this, you know, failed actress came by like a gold digger and married him for his money. And, of course, Lisa's so cynical that when Daniel asks about the marriage, she said, yeah, I married him for his money. He's a terrible guy, you know. So James felt pushed out. You know, most children have a difficult time with a step-parent, but James was an overgrown boy at 50 and is an alcoholic. The only thing he had to go to live for was the death of his father and all the money he would inherit. And now this interloper, Lisa, comes along, marries the old man, and it looks like she's going to get all the money. So is it any wonder he's bitter and continues drinking?
And he's very
and that was his character and how he fit into this kind of bizarre, rich, crazy family. You know, as the FBI agent Gloria Reese in the novel describes them, they were kind of like the Addams Family. And they really are. I mean, you know, as you recall from reading the novel, that was one dysfunctional family.
I know, and he reminded me of Lurch, the father, to be very honest.
Yeah.
And Uncle Fester, too. I think Uncle Fester had more spunk than these guys did.
I think so, too. The only thing they had was money, but they certainly didn't have enough character to handle a real crisis when it finally comes along. And see, I think that's the thing that mystery and suspense novels give us, is you have a kind of ordered world, and all of a sudden a crisis happens, a murder, a robbery, a kidnapping. And what it does is it throws a light on who people really are, that how they behave, how they react, how they contribute to helping or not helping really reveals who they are. And we get to see it all through the eyes of Daniel Rinaldi, our psychologist narrator, and see the family through his eyes. And I think that's one of the things that makes the novel compelling for readers, is Daniel's assessment of people as he goes through this story.
Well, he's very astute. So I'm wondering, when you get a client, or Daniel Rinaldi gets a client, and they walk in and they give you their story or whatever, you can tell right away if they're trying to manipulate the situation to make themselves look better, or if they're telling you the truth.
Well, sometimes. I mean, you know, therapists are not mind readers. We pick up the same verbal and visual cues as anyone else. I think what happens is if you've done it for a long time, and I've been in private practice about 28 years, if you've done it long enough, you kind of get a sense of how authentic a person's being. But I usually don't think it's because they're trying to manipulate me. I think it's because they feel vulnerable and insecure. And so what they're doing is presenting a version of themselves that they think I will like or want to help. And so rather than looking at what they're doing as manipulative, I tend to look at it with empathy and think to myself, wow, you know, they're in a lot of pain and they're going to, you know, leak out slowly the true story. And my job is just to be patient and listen. And that's what I try to do.
And you don't ask questions, you just sort of prod them along, or they just speak?
Sometimes people come in and they have a lot they want to say. Other times, they're more comfortable if I ask them questions. One thing about doing therapy, there's no one-size-fits-all technique.
I gotcha.
It depends on who the person is, how they like to express themselves. Some people are very verbal. Other people are more reticent and shy. And, you know, it doesn't mean they're not being truthful. It means that's their personality. And so I try to fit myself into whatever the personality of the person, of the patient coming in is, so I can better empathize with them and understand them more clearly.
I got it. So what was she like before she married this man, and why in heaven blazes did she marry him?
Who, Lisa?
Yeah, well, that's the one.
Well, the way I describe her in the book is that, you know, she was a small-town girl from a small town east of Pittsburgh. She became a Playboy playmate, went out to Hollywood, made a bunch of lurid, you know, slasher movies.
Mm.
Her career, you know, like a meteor, snuffed out. She got into drugs. She had a couple bad marriages and, you know, came back to Pittsburgh, you know, in her 40s. And as like one of her bitter neighbors says, well, she came back with her tail between her legs. You know, she had no money. Her family had shunned her because she had made all these salacious movies, you know, in which she was often naked and, you know, gang raped and horrible stuff. And so she went looking for a job and found one working at Charles Harlan's company. And within 6 months, she was married to the old guy. That's why so many people think, uh-oh, she was just a gold digger. And by her own admission, she did marry him for his money, but she also felt bad for him, even though he treated her very coldly. And he, of course, saw her as a kind of trophy wife who, you know, while he's in his very, very last years, can, you know, take her around and show all of his rich, famous, and, you know, important friends, look who I got. I'm married to a movie star. The way I imagined it, it would be like as if Sharon Stone or Susan Sarandon were from a small town in Pittsburgh and near Pittsburgh and then came back and married, you know, Andrew Carnegie or something like that.
Oh,
and that's kind of the way I saw it.
Maybe even Hugh Hefner.
Or Hugh Hefner, that's right. Actually, he's a good model. If for a reader, if they're trying to visualize Charles Harlan, just imagine
Hugh Hefner
in a wheelchair. That's exactly who he is.
Not bad for a girl sitting. That's why I sit here with a paper and a pen in my hand, even though I have the question staring at me. I just like whatever. But when Danny tries to find her, and he finds her eventually, why do they think that she made this whole thing up, that she staged her own kidnapping?
Well, Daniel suspects that because he doesn't understand why, you know, how she got kidnapped right outside of his office.
Yeah, that was scary.
Away from everybody. And his fantasy was, well, maybe she really wasn't kidnapped. Maybe she just walked away with the assailant, you know, arm in arm and went, okay, let's plan the kidnapping so that when her husband pays the big, big ransom, she could take the money, run away, and be free of him, but still have a big ton of money to live the rest of her life. That was one of the things he imagined might be true. I don't want to give away whether or not she staged her own kidnapping.
No, we can't do that because there are too many people listening.
But certainly, as the story unfolds, you begin to see why Daniel Rinaldi starts to think that maybe she did stage her own kidnapping. And I'll just have to let the reader find out whether or not she did.
Well, we have some other characters. We have Arthur Drake, who's very interesting and very loyal, and we have Harry Pollack. So why did he keep covering for Daniel and every time he got in trouble? Because Daniel finds himself constantly giving statements to the police, and each time something happened, his poor man seemed involved, and yet he wouldn't walk away. How come?
Well, Harry Polk is one of my favorite characters.
Me too. I like him.
He was a police detective from robbery homicide in Pittsburgh. And he has a kind of grudging admiration for Daniel. At first, in the earlier novels, Mirror Image and Fever Dream, Harry looked at Rinaldi as kind of a pain in the butt. That, you know, he was a civilian, he was a head shrinker as far as he was concerned. But over time, he's developed a kind of grudging respect. They have kind of a love-hate relationship with each other. And even though Harry still finds Daniel's involvement in police cases to be annoying and interfering, Harry also is kind of a maverick in the police. He doesn't like his boss, Lieutenant Beagler. He doesn't like all the rules and regulations. So in a way, Daniel represents a guy who's able to operate more freely than Harry Polk is, because Harry Polk is in the chain of command. You know, he has a lieutenant above him and an assistant chief and Chief Logan and, you know, all the authority figures in the hierarchy of the police. And Daniel Rinaldi, by being a civilian, even though he's a consultant, he is a civilian still, he doesn't have to operate within those same rules. And so I think that that is the source of this fun, uneasy relationship between Harry Polk and Daniel. I mean, a perfect example is Harry Polk is recently divorced, and, you know, in an earlier novel, I have Daniel say to him, well, here's the name of a good therapist. You can talk about your divorce. And he goes, why would I go see a head shrinker like you? You guys are all crazy. All your patients are crazy. Are you saying I'm a crazy person? All I need to do is get drunk. That's my therapy. So you see the world very differently. But I think they've come over the course of the four books to kind of depend on each other.
Well, a lot of people take getting drunk or going on drugs and going on benders as their way of escaping instead of facing the issues.
Yeah, it's the way they self-medicate. Some people self-medicate with food. Some people self-medicate with alcohol or drugs. And some people self-medicate with work. I mean, the goal of any of these stimulants is to distract us from being with whatever it is that's bothering us. You know, as Carl Jung said, neurotics are people who refuse to suffer. Mm. And there's a lot of suffering in life. And, you know, if you can get drunk or if you can smoke weed or if you can, you know, eat like an entire tub of Rocky Road ice cream, it's a way to medicate yourself and numb yourself against those feelings.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think right after my mom got sick and was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and then, just everything taken care of her for 12 years, and then my sister dying, you don't realize what you're doing. You're right. And I'm thin, very thin now, thank God. And my mom, before she died, she looked at me and she said, she knew, you know, I know you retired because I'm sick, but did you have to blimp out?
And
she was as funny as anything. But she didn't quite say it that way. She took her hands and she said, you used to be like this, meaning thin, and she said, now you're as white as an elephant. And like that. And I said to her, and she had Alzheimer's, and I looked at her and I said, sure, you couldn't forget that, could you? And I looked at her and I said, you know, Ma, you're right. And I lost all the weight. I lost 90 pounds. Never gained it back.
Kidding. Really?
No, really. My doc, yeah, I really did.
That's a real achievement.
Yeah, my mother said that, and then my doctor called and said I was fat and my cholesterol was high, and I thanked him so much at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I realized, yeah, well, you retired from teaching too early because I didn't want to. I had to take care of her and deal with everything, and you don't realize it. And I walked into a store, and I said, I want that outfit in a size 8, and she said, no, you need it in a size 28. I was a 24. And you don't realize it. Yeah, and I'm not an eataholic. I don't pick out on food. But you know what? We were going out every single day to the wrong places, and I'm saying, this doesn't fit right. Oh, the cleaners must be shrinking it. And then I realized, rocket scientist, you've got a high IQ. You're 1 point short of Mensa. And where is your brain here? And then I just went on a regular diet. It took me 5 years, but yeah. I would never do it again. People just don't realize what they're doing. And the one thing I realized in this book is there's a lot of issues. Acceptance, forgiveness, greed, politics, understanding, social class, and wealth. And all of these apply to all of the characters, including Daniel, everyone in the book. But as you're going through it, there are several characters, if you notice, that I didn't mention.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, there are several that relate back to, you know, places that are in the news, in the, you know, war zones. And I said maybe I better not mention them because that might give away too much.
Yeah, I think that that's wise. But I
that's
do appreciate
why, yeah, that's why I crossed them out.
We can talk about Daniel's best friend, who is Noah Fry, a paranoid schizophrenic who works at a bar that Daniel frequents. And Noah is sort of like my Greek chorus. Mm. He's the, you know, the humane wisdom of the crazy person. And I always like the conversations between Daniel and Noah.
Well, yeah, that we could talk about, and that's definitely true. But they were like, I said, let me look at these questions, and I said, I better not bring these three in because they're going to give away who is behind the whole mess.
Okay, I appreciate that very much.
Yeah, well, I didn't put it in my review either. I'm going to check it out. I believe that if a reviewer puts in a spoiler, I always send my reviews to authors. Well, you saw what I wrote, so that's okay. I usually send my review to the author. I won't change what I wrote, but if I accidentally put in what the author thinks is a spoiler, and I think they're right, person's right, I'm going to take it out.
Yeah, I appreciate.
However, if the author tells me that my review is very detailed and can I make it shorter, I go, that's the way it goes.
Should write the review that you want to write.
Yeah, I write it my way and in my own different kind of form because, you know, that's just me. But throughout the novel, Danny changes his perspective about the case. And why does he, even he clashes with the police all the time in this particular case. And they didn't want him there. And yet, no matter what happened, he was always there.
Well, in one way, he had no choice.
Yeah.
If you recall,
the
kidnapper says, I don't want any policemen or
any
federal officers involved in delivering the ransom. And so the kidnapper chooses Daniel. Going to do? Is he going to say, no, I'm not going to deliver the ransom, go ahead and kill Lisa? He has to. I tried to figure out a way where there was no conceivable reason Daniel would be able in good conscience to walk away from the danger he was in. And so, but as the case goes on, he begins to think about it a little bit differently, realizing that some of the things he thought, some of the people he thought might be guilty or might be behind the kidnapping, that he was actually wrong. And I never have a problem with my lead character guessing wrong a lot of the time, because there's a lot of trial and error as a therapist, and there's a lot of trial and error, I think, in realistic protagonists. I never liked the heroes of mysteries or suspense novels where they're always right all the time. They're that way from the beginning of the book to the end. I don't find that realistic. I don't find it interesting. I like a lead character that kind of gropes his or her way through the story and then, you know, gets little flashes of insight and learns as he or she goes along how to build up a picture in their mind as to what might be going on. I think that's more realistic, and it makes more interesting narrative journey for the reader.
I agree, because, you know, if everything goes right, then it gets boring. And if everything is perfect, then why did you need to write the mystery?
That's right.
And the only time I get upset is if, I mean, a lead character that gets in trouble or he needs some help or it doesn't go exactly to plan, that makes sense because real life is not perfect and everything is not going to go according to plan. But I've read some murder mysteries by whomever, and when the lead character gets into so much trouble that he can't seem to get out of his own way, then I go like, you got to be kidding. That's impossible. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, there's a phrase that somebody used one time called Too Stupid to Live. And
yeah,
that's when a character does a series of things that are either so outrageous or so potentially dangerous or so reckless that you go, oh, hell, the heck with it. You're too stupid to live. They should kill you, you know? And so you always walk a fine line with a lead character, they have to be brave and resourceful, and they have to take risks, but they can't seem to take stupid risks because then the reader loses patience with them and says, what are you, crazy? Pick up the phone, call the police, and hightail it out of there. You know, so you always have to walk that line. You know, I mean, for a character to grab the reader, the character has to be strong, inventive, resourceful, and willing to take risks, but can't cross the line over to reckless, stupid, unheeding, thoughtless, because then the reader doesn't want to identify with that character.
That's
the reader goes, well, you were, you know, stupid to do it in the first place.
Well, that's
so you're
that's
right.
True.
It's a fine line.
That's true, because I there was only one book where I actually refused to finish the book when the police chief decided that his detectives were incapable of handling a case, and his people that worked for him couldn't handle it, so he hired a retired sergeant to handle the case. And I'm saying, no chief of police is going to say that his detectives can't handle a case. That didn't make any sense. And also, he had the sergeant's wife was classifying the bones of the body that was found. And I'm saying, there's no way that this lady that had nothing to do with the police was going to be allowed to touch the bones of a body and come to a crime scene. It just made no sense. So it's one of the times where I said, I'm not going to finish it. So what is next for Danny Rinaldi? What are you going to plan next?
Well, the next novel is I can't say too much about it, but it's going to continue his adventures as a police consultant. And he's also going to have an opportunity to look into the death of his wife.
She
were mugged many, many years ago coming out of a restaurant in Pittsburgh. And there's some maybe new evidence that maybe that wasn't just a simple mugging. And we'll follow his search for the truth about what actually happened. That'll be one of the things in the book. It may not be the main story, but it'll certainly be an important aspect. And we'll hopefully also see what develops in his romantic life.
I was just going to ask that.
which is kind of on hold. He has been involved with Sergeant Polk's partner, Eleanor Lowry, and they've taken a sort of sabbatical in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So in the next book, I'm going to have to figure out what happens in that relationship. And, you know, the thing is, I write these books to find out what's going to happen. I don't plan them ahead very much. I just put Daniel in a situation and I follow my nose. And so I look forward myself to seeing what's going to happen to him.
Well, you see, then I have to tell you about my new show before we close.
I'd love to hear about it.
You see, got it. I got to get everybody to do this. This is great. The first one is going to be on October 28th. I had this brainstorm, and I just hope it really works. It's called Let's Write. It's not on this network. It's on Red River Radio. And the first show is going to have John Lesqua, Mark Rubenstein, and Mary Martin, and we're going to talk about the art of writing the novel, not a particular book. Of course, if you bring in an incident from your book, that's fine. And we're going to deal with, the first show is going to be, how do you take a recurring character and create different plots for that character so that the reader doesn't get bored? And in John's case, he has a lot of recurring characters. How do you decide which one you want to spotlight within your novel, and how do you decide which minor characters are going to support that main character when he gets in trouble? And that's just part of the thrust of the first show. We're going to talk about reoccurring characters. Mark and Mary wrote three. His is two books, but he's going to write the third. He better write the third because I got to find out what happens to the last character. And she wrote a trilogy. So how do you keep the trilogy? When you end one book, do you start it with the ending of the next book? Start with the ending of that, or do you start something different? How do you keep it going so that even if you end the trilogy, that you might want to bring the character back. So that's the first one. The second one is going to be on setting. Carla Negers writes about Ireland and Declan's Cross, which is a fake place, but she wrote about Boston Harbor. Tom Sawyer is going to talk about putting his character in Las Vegas, because he hates it, being out of his venue. Alan Topol is going to talk about his research and places, you know, different settings for his characters. And Stuart Yates writes historical fiction. So we're going to talk about setting and what happens when you take a character out of their comfort zone.
This sounds like a wonderful idea for a series of programs.
Writing tips, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, John Lesguaz is one of my favorite writers and a great guy. And
yeah.
So is Tom Sawyer. And so I think
they've
you've
lined
up. They
volunteered to do this for me, to make me look good, let me tell you.
We've lined up
some
great program, that's for sure.
The third one is one person, because she asked to do the show herself, and we're going to talk about her many reoccurring characters and her new book, and that would be the one and only Tess Gerrinson.
Oh, my
that's
gosh.
December. Tess is the first New York Times bestselling author I ever interviewed, ever. And I emailed her herself on her website, and I was like, almost fell off my chair when she agreed to do it. And she's phenomenal. And Die Again, well, you'll never go on an African safari. But did you ever write true crime?
No, I never have.
Yeah, well, the show in January is we're going to talk about Larry Thompson and Stephen Shukas, the author of Poison, which scared me. We're going to talk about how you write true crime and how you relate it, bring it into a novel. And Larry's brother was a police officer, so he's going to be talking about him. And he said he just wrote a novel on true crime. So that's going to be January show. February, I haven't decided. I haven't gotten that far. But basically, it's writing tips. If any one of the shows seem great to you, just let me know, and I could always add another author. It's going to be great.
Sound great to me, too.
Yeah,
really.
They are. It's going to be a lot of fun to talk about, you know, reoccurring characters and how you create the different settings and the dialogue and how you keep it going. And John has this really bad habit of killing off my favorite people. He kills off main characters, but he was told that if he kills off Wyatt Hunt, he's going to be in trouble. Because he can't kill off the gorgeous the private eye. He can kill off his wife. I don't care. But he cannot kill her off. And he cannot kill off Dibmus Hardy or Abe Gottsky, because he's already killed off two other people, and that's no good. But anyway, so where can everybody find out more about you and your books?
Well, I guess the best place is in my website. It's DennisPalumbo.com. That's DennisPalumbo.com. And all my books are listed, all their reviews and blurbs about them. And where I'm going to be, you know, appearing, I'm going to be, you know, I do signings and I give writing workshops all over. So
nice.
People can look there on my website. And I hope your listeners will consider checking out the Daniel Rinaldi. Like I said, there are four novels so far, and I've just started the fifth. And I hope some of your listeners will check them out.
Well, I'm going to put all this information on my – I have a million review sites that I run my way. And one of them is on Facebook. It's called Reviewing Your Book. And I really wish people would understand that all you can post there is a request for a review or a review of a book that you've reviewed or somebody did of your book. And all promotions are on the site called Authors with Style. And those you can promote your Kindle, whatever you want. But I have my specific site on WordPress, which is called Just Reviews. And everybody reads them. They read all my stuff. I have no idea, but they just do. So I'm going to post it in a few minutes, and this way everybody will be able to read my review of this book. And when is this next one coming out so I can, you know, pencil you in for another interview?
Gosh, I don't know. Usually my books come out about 18 months apart. So
oh, wow.
My guess would be beginning of 2016. That would be my guess. remember, I have a full-time private practice, so I only get to write a couple hours a day. And so I wish I could write more of them, but I do have my patients to think about. So I write a little slower than a lot of other mystery novelists, but I also, you know, try to make each one of them as unique and well-written and infused with literary quality as I can.
Well, I hope that you come to the Thriller Fest again next year.
Oh,
because
absolutely.
I told John Land that it's his turn to invite me to come, or Larry Thompson, because I haven't had so much fun. It was so much fun. It really was. I mean,
it really was.
Meeting
Are
all
you
of
be
you. Meeting,
go to BoucherCon in Long Beach?
Because
I'm doing a couple panels, and I'm moderating a panel on psychological mysteries. So if you get down to BoucherCon in Long Beach in a couple of weeks, I'll see you there.
I'm in upstate New York.
Well, then I think it's unlikely you're going to make it there. But
yeah, I know. I wish everybody would come to New York. And,
well,
you know,
I came for
come up
Fest,
to Westchester,
so.
New York. You guys have to come up to Westchester to the bookstores up here to get signing so that I can come and tell everybody how great the book is.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been really a lot of fun. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're very, very welcome, and don't forget me when the book comes out. And if
I
you decide you
won't.
Want to be on Let's Write, just let me know. One is October 28th and one is November 25th.
Okay, I'll definitely let you know.
Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you so much, Fran.
You're welcome. Have a nice night. Bye.
Thank you.